This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 4th of January 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, I'm joined by my guests Sebastian Borger and John Everard to pick apart the day's news. We'll look at crumbling relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, then head to a traffic-filled bridge between Sweden and Denmark to scope out the future of Europe's open borders. All that plus a primer on military conscription and the latest in jihadist propaganda and China's rocky economy. That and more starting right now on Midori House. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are two regular Monocle 24 contributors, the London-based German journalist Sebastian Borger and John Everard, former ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Welcome both to the programme. Let's kick it off with today's top story. Two of the Middle East's biggest geopolitical heavyweights have cut off diplomatic ties. Yesterday, Saudi Arabia announced it would sever ties with Iran. Though the two have, of course, been foes for many years, this particular spat began when Riyadh executed an Iranian-trained Shia cleric, leading to a mob storming Saudi's embassy in Tehran. Analysts have warned that the expulsion of Iranian diplomats is very bad news indeed for the region. John, let's start with you. What do we know about how this has unfolded? It doesn't seem to really make sense for outsiders. You know, this cleric was obviously somebody the Saudis didn't like, but there was a very easy thing. You could expel him, you could imprison him. The route of execution seems to have taken many people both in the country and outside of it by surprise.
That's right, it did. And it's not entirely clear how we got to where we are on that. It seems that the process was being pushed by the interior minister, who's a known hardliner, and we don't know how far other people in the Saudi regime were kept in the loop. It is even less clear how Saudi Arabia arrived at its decision to break off diplomatic relations with Tehran, which, of course, is quite a significant step. I mean, it turns, in a sense, what started out as a Syrian civil war into a Sunni-Shia confrontation across the Muslim world, especially now that so many other countries have joined Saudi Arabia in breaking off ties with Iran. This is starting to look quite ugly and very, very muddled.
Sebastian, what's your reading of what is happening? Do you think it is now a kind of an even more decisive split than we've even seen in recent years between Sunni and Shia? We see so many wars in the region unfolding along these lines. Does this make things even more difficult to resolve, you know, disputes in Iraq, in Syria? Is this even more entrenched than it was just a week ago?
Just before Christmas, we were celebrating the fact that these two were sitting together at the table, at the Vienna table, where people talk about a solution to the Syrian civil war. It's very bad news, absolutely. And also, you start worrying about who is actually there who could bang heads together. Is the US, which traditionally would have had that role, strong enough? Obama in his last year? Are the Russians engaged enough to do anything other than just prop up President Assad of Syria?
If we just go back, you know, a few months, what's really interesting is when the kind of peace deal, the nuclear deal was done with Iran, you know, there was a feeling, you know, in if you sat in Saudi, that this was going to be against Saudi Arabia, that, you know, the West was going to in the future align itself a little bit more with the Iranian view, and that's what their fear was. Well, they've done their best at making sure that happens, because really for the first time in Western governments, you've seen it here in London, you've seen it out of Washington, they are not backing Saudi this time. They can't. They've said, you know, we're surprised, we're a little bit disappointed, this cannot help. Are we seeing, actually, in this very moment, actually the Saudis have really misplayed this? They're going to begin to lose their authority in all of these capitals where, in the past, their oil might has held sway.
I think that is quite possible. The American reaction had all the hallmarks of a government that had been caught by surprise and really didn't like being caught by surprise. The heavy-handed mention of keeping channels open and the conversation being a good thing is about the as close as you get to a slap across the face if you are major allies like Saudi Arabia and the United States are.
Here speaks the former ambassador to North Korea.
Well, yes. The Saudi has managed to carry most of the Sunni world with it. I mean, as I was saying a minute ago, it is not just Saudi Arabia that's broken relations with Iran, but a whole slew of other Sunni countries too. There are some interesting silences, not a squeak out of Cairo. The Egyptians are keeping their heads very, very low and doubtless hoping that they can dodge this storm. The Russian offer to mediate between the two is hilarious. I mean, the Russians are knee-deep in on the Shia side. They have been working hand in glove with the Iranians for a long time. They have no credibility whatever as mediators. And I wonder whether the offer was made slightly tongue-in-cheek.
Also, what's interesting, I guess, is that so many Muslim people from both Sunni and Shia have to go to Saudi Arabia every year for the Hajj, to visit Mecca. It's going to be very difficult for, I hear that, we see today that Saudi Arabia says they will not stop people travelling for these reasons. But, one Iranian is going to feel a bit uncomfortable kind of landing suddenly in Saudi, and we don't know what will actually happen on the ground. But that would be, in religious terms, an extraordinary thing if people felt that there was a Sunni-Shia split in going to Mecca.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, remember that the formal title of the King of Saudi Arabia is the guardian of the two holy mosques. That is his raison d'etre. That's why Saudi Arabia, in theory, is there. If you do not allow Muslims to come to the two holy mosques, then there's going to be, I don't know, outrage at the very least, and effectively you undermine the legitimacy of, such as it is, of the Saudi regime.
They might want to travel to Jerusalem instead.
Well, now that would be a thought, wouldn't it? Yes. Other points I think need bringing out here. The various powers involved have all got Muslim minorities of their own. Actually, maybe not so much the United States. Russia, of course, has got a lot of Muslims. Almost all of them are Sunnis. And it is going to be interesting to see how the Russian Muslim minority plays out, given that the Moscow has now thrown in its hand effectively with the Shia, if there is a major Shia-Sunni confrontation. Squeaks of anxiety coming out of Beijing as well. Beijing, not directly involved in the Middle East and very anxious to keep out, but with a huge, restive and increasingly violent Sunni minority. It all looks very difficult.
And do you think, for the Saudis, I guess what's interesting is, that we've talked about their oil wealth in the past. Well, it's much diminished at the moment, and there's some pressure at home about how they're going to spend it. And it does look as though there's going to be restraints on their budgets. But in a way, if they're a little bit diminished on the as a power, as a petropower, then when they come knocking on other capitals, do you think that's one of the reasons why the other, kind of the Western governments have been a bit kind of slower to kind of jump behind them and say, don't worry about it, we'll support you? Because then they think, actually, in this kind of oil glut market, we're not so dependent on being as nice to you. Sure, you buy lots of our arms and you kind of help us in that way, but we're not we're not hooked into you as we were in recent years.
I think that might well be an element. I have to say that most of the Western reactions look like a kind of "you did what" sort of reaction and disbelief that the Saudis have gone ahead and broken relations in this way. What you've just said applies not just to Saudi Arabia there too, but to oil producers in general, with a massive oil glut, which is going to get worse because OPEC is effectively dead. I mean, if it looks very unlikely that you'd ever have an oil production agreement that included both Saudi Arabia and Iran anytime soon. And without those two key players signed up to an agreement, nothing is worth a paper written on. So the oil producers as a group are each going to produce and produce and produce, keep all the market share they can, ignore pleas from others for restraint, and the oil price is likely to sink a great deal further.
And Sebastian, do you think, lastly on this, I think what's interesting is you can't help but be, if you're watching these events and these countries as an outsider, you can't help but thinking in terms of who's good and who's bad. And actually, this has kind of showed us what a rubbish kind of method of looking at nations that is, because are the Iranians the goodies in this? Are the Saudis? But that's, in a way, that's the simplicity of foreign policy. We've felt Saudis are our friends; they're the good people, and because of that, you know, we've turned our head to, you know, beheadings, imprisonments, the lack of political freedoms, the fact that a woman can't drive a car, really basic rights for being denied to people. We've turned our head because we think actually they're a friend of ours, because we do think in these simplistic terms.
I don't know whether we do. I mean, we've got the former foreign policy actor around the table. He can tell us more about it. I don't think people who deeply think about foreign policy and thereby influence it, the people who act foreign policy don't think in those terms, I don't think. It's the old chestnut of realism and idealism. We want to spread Western values around the world while acknowledging that other people have other ideas. And the relationship with Saudi Arabia, I think, over the last decades was always based on realism, to keep this extremely volatile region in check. We needed to close our, well, we, I don't know whether we needed to, but we did close our eyes to all everything that you described. But let's not forget that it's not looking terribly pretty in Iran either, you know.
We shouldn't be exactly picking friends. You have very little rights
for women. It's an extremely unpleasant situation to be in.
Well, we're going to leave the region now and head to Europe for the latest fallout over the continent's refugee crisis. Sweden introduced ID checks today for people travelling into the country from Denmark, with Denmark quickly following suit by imposing checks on its border with Germany. So has borderless travel on the continent completely eroded? Sebastian, we'll start with you. Are the Germans to blame for all of this?
Yes, of course. we finished 2015 on this note, and of course, let's go on in 2016. Why don't we?
That's why we hauled you in.
it's still yes. I mean, and to be honest, there is a problem with the way Angela Merkel initially announced her new policy of taking basically everybody, and she's now rowing away from that. But to be also fair to her, you know, that there had been months and months of torturous negotiations, and countries like Denmark, Hungary, the United Kingdom, didn't offer any help whatsoever. So this is now going to play out. It doesn't look pretty, absolutely. But
do you think that Angela Merkel, when she you know, when that happened, and then in the subsequent months when she saw there was no really proper negotiated deal to be put into play, do you think she realised, actually, if we do kind of very little, the numbers of people here who can't find jobs and homes and who have contacts elsewhere, they will disperse naturally? Do you think there was a feeling within some of the ministries, it doesn't matter, if we do nothing, this will sort itself out? Do you think there's a bit of kind of, there is some plan behind what seems like a failure?
It's always very, very nice to, as a German, to be thought of as meticulous and having a great master plan. I'm afraid it doesn't work like that. Not even in German ministries. I think they've been caught by surprise. They've been improvising as best they can. The population is doing a great deal and very remarkable you know, attitude towards all the refugees coming in. But no, I don't think there's a plan. There is a considerable ill will increasingly towards these smaller neighbours who are seen as not pulling their weight at all. Denmark is one of those.
John, the action by Sweden effectively put kind of a cork in the bottle and meant that, you know, as migrants moved up through Europe, they would stop in Denmark. That would be the end of the journey. So obviously the Danes felt, you know, we need to now move that cork further down the line.
Which is exactly what the Swedes wanted. And that's what they said they wanted. It's not just Germany who is annoyed with Denmark. Sweden has taken, I think, 160,000 refugees so far. Denmark, I believe, is 19,000, which even, you know, for relative sizes and so on, is much, much lower uptake. And effectively, I think the Swedes felt that the Danes were prepared to let any number of refugees through because they knew they would all eventually just cross that great bridge into Sweden and they'd be off Denmark's hands. Closing the bridge, of course, changes that. And sure enough, within hours, the Danes had done exactly what the Swedes wanted and closed the border with Germany. So that what was a Danish-Swedish problem now becomes a German problem. That is where the refugees will start to pile up against the new dam.
Now, the bigger question, of course, is, well, one of the bigger questions is the Schengen Agreement, the understanding that Europeans should be able to move across borders without passports being checked, without having to queue at kind of immigration stations. Do we think this is temporarily? Because the Danes have said that, you know, this is a measure for 10 days initially while we kind of reassess the situation. But do either of you feel that there is long-term going to be a threat to the way that we travel around around Europe?
It goes deeper than Schengen. Remember that from the 1950s, so long, long before Schengen, there was a free movement agreement amongst the Nordic countries, and it is most unusual for that to be curtailed. So the blocks on the bridge between Denmark and Sweden really have sent shockwaves through a lot of societies. Do I think that the Danish measures will last only 10 days? No, I don't. I think they'll be extended and extended and extended. I think, however, provided the Danes do manage to hold the wall, so to speak, that quite soon we'll see the bridge between Denmark and Sweden reopened, just once the Swedes have made their point.
Well, let's stay in Sweden for a moment, because there's been a report that suggests that 70% of Swedes want military conscription to return to the country, with only 16% saying it was a bad idea. Compulsory service was scrapped in 2010. Sebastian, interestingly, Germany, for a long time, a nation, a believer in conscription. What's your take on this?
Very interesting, because I think there are similar, not similar figures, but there is a considerable minority in Germany that thinks on equal terms. I mean, it's one opinion poll, of course. You never quite know what to make of that. And apparently the Swedes have had great problems recruiting for their professional army recently. Maybe people just think, well, if they can't get the people through recruitment, we just give them our youngsters anyway for a period of time and hope that that solves the problem, which, of course, it doesn't, because what you need nowadays are professional armies. You can't make do with people who are there for 6, 9, or 12 months.
Did you do conscription yourself?
I, in fact, chose the civil service alternative.
But that's interesting, isn't it? Because I wonder if, you know, that we often talk about conscription here at Monocle, because one of the interesting things is it does have this other side to it that, you know, I know that part of the problem here is about getting enough people for the military. But on the other side, there is an attempt when you're trying to build some kind of national understanding, some kind of common values, some shared belief, an attempt to make people men and women who can, you know, fix a plug and look after themselves. It has a practical element, even if you don't go into the military side of it.
A friend of mine served with the pioneers in the Alps, and ever since then he has a very good friend from a totally different region in Germany, from a completely different social class, which simply would not have happened but for the army. There's no doubt about it. I have a nephew who was in very, very bad shape at the end of his, well, he actually then gave up schooling altogether, and he was drafted, and he thrived in the military. Those stories, of course, are there. There's no doubt about it. And also, I think the military in Germany has played a very good role in bringing the two parts, East and West, together after reunification. A lot of Westerners had never been to East Germany, and vice versa. So that was a very, very important melting pot.
John, are you a believer in conscription?
I am a believer in conscription to a certain point. I agree entirely with Sebastian that you cannot run an army on conscripts alone. Modern weaponry and the requirements it imposes on soldiers is simply too complex. You need a professional army. But it does no harm at all to have backup, whether you have a reservist system like in the UK, in the United States, or a conscription service where you know, people do their 6, 9, 12 months, wherever it might be, so that if the worst comes to the worst, at least you've got people who know certain military basics and can pitch in and offer some kind of assistance. And I think Sebastian's right to point to the way that this knocks class barriers down. It's done so in a number of other countries with which I've had to deal. And people I I know who've done conscription from a range of backgrounds, slightly to my surprise, have tended to say that they enjoyed it and got a lot out of it.
They even have it in North Korea, don't they?
In North Korea. In North Korea, it's 8 years going on 10. It's a little bit different. You're taking a young man's entire youth away from him. It's a bit rough.
Men, not women.
Girls don't fight in North Korea.
I see. Well, yeah. But of course, that would have to change. And indeed, the Swedes are saying, if it happens, it must be both sexes together.
That's right. Yeah. In Sweden, of course, they have the huge problem. They are about 50% understaffed in their military. It's getting quite desperate.
Well, interesting, taking it from both my guests today, who are John Everard and Sebastian Borgo. We're going to be back in just a minute, but this is Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
What we're trying to do is to keep our tentacles spread far and wide, I suppose, for this vast, vast country and this really dynamic city too here in Toronto, to try and bring the most accurate and the most vibrant flavour we can of this place that we hold so dearly to us.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are John Everard and Sebastian Borger. Let's continue our review of the day's news with a look at Islamic State's recent propaganda battles with the West. The group has released a new video showing the killing of five men who they allege were spying for Britain. The film features a man and a young boy, both with British accents. David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, has called it a desperate measure. Are we losing this battle, John?
No, we are winning it. Islamic State are quite visibly losing it. They are rattled and they are starting to lose the kind of kudos that they spent so long building up. Ever since they lost Sinjar, which effectively cut the two areas controlled by Islamic State in two. I mean, it becomes much more difficult without Sinjar to travel from the Iraqi-held territories, to the territories held in Iraq, to those held in Syria. They've been on the back foot. Ramadi is just the latest in its whole series of setbacks. And if assessments are true that this particularly sickening video that they just released is actually the result of a huge internal witch hunt to find who it was guided those missiles against Jihadi John, then again, you've got a regime that seems to be turning against its own people. There's no evidence that anybody's put forward that these five were in any way guilty. This is a witch hunt in the best medieval traditions.
Do you feel that they're on the back foot? Sure, they've been maybe dislodged from Ramadi, but what's left of Ramadi is a pile of rubble with very few places for anyone to live. They still seem to be entrenched on the outskirts of the town. The idea of taking Mosul seems a long, long way off. And when you look at the map, the lands they control still stretch, all across Iraq and deep into Syria.
The West could, if it wanted to, win this war militarily in a matter of months. It doesn't want to because it's got its fingers very badly burned recently. On the propaganda side, I think it's we only talk about them winning in propaganda terms because our media aren't dealing with it very cleverly. I've got here in front of me the headline of the London Evening Standard with a picture of this boy who we seem to already know the name of this boy whose mother left the United Kingdom 3 years ago. I'm not sure whether there's any news in that. We've seen pictures of children before in videos. We've seen very gruesome execution videos before. I think it's a very short item on page 27, nothing more.
Well, we're not going to dwell too long on that story because we're going to go to China now, where a rocky economic outlook and chaos on the stock market led to an actual halt in trading today. Global stocks stumbled as well today on the first trading day of 2016. Is this a premonition of things to come for both China and for the year ahead? John, you're the wise man on this. Tell us.
Yes, I mean, not just the first day of trading, but the very first day that they introduced what they call the circuit breakers, an automatic system that cuts off trading if the value of stocks overall falls more than 7% in a day. The very first day that they had the system, it does just that and trading is cut out. It's not looking pretty. I mean, for your stock exchange to be closed down looks bad anywhere. For it to happen as a result of dire figures on the Chinese, the critical Chinese manufacturing sector looks a lot worse. And all the time, of course, China has this massive debt overhang and deep doubts that its official economic figures are worth anything. It's a brave man now, I think, who actually quotes with a straight face the Chinese claim that their economy is growing at 7%. There seems to be a consensus forming around 3.5%, 4%, maybe 4.5% a year, which is simply too slow for China. China has to produce jobs in enormous numbers to keep a growing graduate population employed. Otherwise, you get highly educated, articulate Chinese who have swatted their blood for so many years and find at the end of it that there is no job. And these people get angry.
And just tell me, you say get angry. You'd hinted earlier, the problems with Muslim question as well. Is there a feeling with the context you have there that there could be social unrest if the economy falls back to a kind of a flat rate or to a 1% growth rate or something?
Absolutely. One of the curious things about dealing with China is that when you look at China from the outside, you have this sense of burgeoning superpower, creating islands of the South China Sea, standoffs with the United States, walking tall, all these things. When you talk to Chinese think tanks in China, you have this constant narrative of existential angst, of a regime that is never quite sure whether it's going to be around over the next few months. Crisis after crisis after crisis. Corruption on the one hand, ethnic and religious tensions on the other hand. All of them out of any kind of control, and nobody can see a way out. It's frankly not pretty at all.
Well, we have time for one final story. I don't think Sebastian will mind not commenting on the Chinese stock exchange.
I would have liked
today.
To have commented,
okay,
but there we are.
You can have 10 seconds.
Just because for once, I'm much more of an optimist here.
Okay.
I'm normally the doomsayer.
Okay, come on, optimist.
Much more of an optimist. I think China's regime is tightly in place. I think I thought the reaction today of the European markets was the much more shocking, because seriously, we've known that the Shanghai Stock Exchange is a laughing stock. We've known that for 10 years. Now they've introduced this circuit breaker, and promptly European bourses fall by 4%. I think it's ridiculous. No, don't underestimate China.
Sebastian and I then do the 2016 end of year review. Yes, he was right.
Well,
you can both invest in Monocle £10. So, laughing stocks, I think that's a whole new category on the bourse. Anyway, finally, Mao may have had his little red book, but is Vladimir Putin attempting to create his own lasting fame on the printed page? Putin has apparently sent a 400-page book of his personal quotations to as many as 1,000 officials across the country. The book, a New Year's gift, is titled Words That Change the World. Sebastian, do you want a copy?
I most certainly would like a copy, and I shall read it diligently every night of this year. You must, of course, be precise and say that he hasn't sent it. And in fact, the Kremlin is trying to distance itself from this enterprise.
Although it's Mr. Volodin.
Yeah, love Volodin. Yes, and he's actually saying, isn't he saying, Putin's words can be described as prophetic. So there we have it. He's not just a great wrestler and with animals and ladies and all that, but he's also German ladies amongst them, but he's also now clearly someone who is almost on the verge of the divine.
Well, because it says that some of his speeches preordained world events. Now, that's some going, isn't it?
That's right, yes. The Russian word that's translated there means that you say something and because you said it, it comes about. So it's not just prophecy. No, we have the power of simply speaking the future and creating it. I think we probably have, at this stage, crossed the line into divinity.
I wonder, is there maybe a possibility? I mean, there's Christmas is different in Russia. Is maybe the 1st of April different in Russia as well? April Fool?
Well, maybe. We could have asked John about the Red Book as well, but that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. I want to say my special thanks to Sebastian Borger and John Everard for joining me here today. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Gaia Lutz and by Ilana Hanukov. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, Colette Rebello will bring you Monocle's international playlist. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show with Mr. Robert Bound. But from me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say thank you very much for listening and have a good day.